This is Dr. What, Dr. Where, Stories of Rural Medicine. It's the podcast exploring what it's like to live, work, and train in rural medicine across regional Victoria. Research is often touted as a way to take your career to the next level, but it also drives healthcare delivery. Today's research projects become tomorrow's best practices, and so research in regional Australia is critical to delivering health outcomes these communities need. And there's so much to learn before you even start your project. In this episode, we'll cover some fundamentals of research to get you started. And one area that's important to think about right from the start is ethics. When you're taking on a project that needs ethics clearance, there's lots of things to establish during this process that can also help you frame up your research to make sure you get the most out of it. Here's Pam Harvey, the Director of Rural Nursing and Allied Health Partnerships at Monash Rural Health, to explain.
I think we'd better start with the definition of research and what we're talking about here, because a lot of people get confused between research and evaluation and quality assurance, and they have different outcomes, intended outcomes. So if we're thinking about research, we often think about things that are going to be published. So things that might be replicated in an article for a journal. That sort of research has a different set of parameters to the research or the evaluation you might do within a health service to make sure that the program that you're doing produces best outcomes for the people that are involved in the program. So it's legitimate to do lots of evaluation on the work that you do as a health professional, and even to record that as a quality assurance act, which is good for accreditation purposes for a hospital, but also helps to show the rest of your team best practice within that program. And that level of, I'm going to call it research, but it's evaluation and quality assurance, should be what we do iteratively as health professionals. And it doesn't have the same boundaries as a pure research activity would.
So whereabouts within research, evaluation, quality assurance does ethics come into play?
Yeah, really good question. So there are a couple of guiding parameters, standards. I think you're going to put them in your show notes. Okay, so there is a national statement on ethical conduct in human research that Australians follow for their research projects. And it set out quite concisely what you're allowed to do in research. There's just been a revision of this document, so it's really hot off the press. There's also an accompanying document that looks at quality assurance projects. So in the national standards is your go-to document for what you're allowed to do during research. And the biggest thing about an ethics consideration is, are your participants protected? Is their privacy protected? Are they protected physically and emotionally by the conduct of your research? And that's what an ethics committee will always be looking at when you submit an ethics application. So Monash, for example, has an ethics committee that oversees all the research that's done at Monash University as a whole. And the ethics committee consists of academics, clearly, people active in research, but it also has a whole range of other people, lay people, people with pastoral care duties to themselves, so that we get the gamut of views from everyone to check that the participants in research are protected. What ultimately the ethics committee will be doing is looking at how your research affects participants and the greater good of the world for conducting this research. So it doesn't necessarily look at the scientific merit or the methodology of the research, but it is primarily concerned with participants and what happens to them. And I think in a rural context, that's a really important thing for researchers who are conducting pure research, research that's going to be published in a wider arena. They really need to consider the participants we're using or involving in this research project. Is it all possible that they might be identified? Because in rural communities, numbers are much smaller. And if you were doing clinical research about a particular condition, you might find that your participant might be the only person who has that condition in a small rural town, and therefore the possibility of them being identified is greater than if they were living in a metropolitan area.
In terms of mitigating those risks of identifying participants or any other ethical concerns with research in a rural setting, how would someone go about trying to mitigate them?
Well, one of the easiest things to do, and people don't want to hear this, but if you work your way through an ethics application, all the answers are there within the form. And most institutions, universities and health services have a very similar form to fill in these days. Once you've worked through the parameters of those of the form, it makes you think about how your research might affect the participant in many ways. For example, you're asked, what are the risks to the participant? Are there any risks to this participant other than, you know, slight discomfort for their time being involved in this project? And if there is a risk, you need to consider how you're going to mitigate that risk. For example, if you're doing a research project that might involve questioning people about traumatic incidents, how are you going to make sure that your participant is safe when they answer those questions, but also how they manage afterwards? So you might be asked to think about, well, if a person finds your questions really triggering during your session, how are you as the person who's interviewing that person, how are you going to cope with that? What services are you going to refer people on to? Do you decide to stop the interview, for example, or do you continue on? You know, these are all the things that you need to think about as you plan your research. So risk is a big thing, but also keep talking about identifying people. You really need to make sure that the identity of the person is preserved, their privacy is preserved.
And in terms of that ethics clearance process, how onerous is it to go through something like that?
Well, I'm going to say I don't think it's onerous at all, really. That's probably something that I would say, wouldn't I? It's the thoroughness of it. It's just making you think about, from the very start, is this research a worthwhile proposition to do? Because what you're actually asking participants to do is devote time to it. No matter if they're patients or clinicians or academics or students, you are asking them for their precious time. So is there a gap in the knowledge that needs this research project to fill? So that would be the first thing. So once you've thought through that and you've got very clear research questions, it's how you're going to answer the questions that the rest of the form will make you consider, right down to how much time is this going to take? How many people do I need to involve to make it a worthwhile research project? So I guess, yes, in a way, it has an onerous component because you've got to be very thorough in how you plan it out. And also when you present that application to an ethics committee, they'll often have questions that they want answered. If you have done a really good job in the first place, those questions will be less. So you don't have to go through several iterations of an ethics application before it's approved.
It really helps streamline the process and, as you mentioned earlier, mitigate any sort of risks to participants and that sort of thing. Are there any ways that going through this ethics process can strengthen the overall research project?
Yes, I think just by completing it, it does strengthen it. You have to be very clear on your questions are and how you're going to answer those questions, your research questions I'm talking about. So by actually forcing yourself through this application will make you think about different things, like with large data sets, for example, sometimes people ask for a waiver of consent, which means that they're asking for permission to use the data without actually asking the participants who lent their data to the database in the first place. And it might be because the number of participants that lent their data to that is huge, and you can't possibly ask 10,000 people for permission to use that data. But you have to be thinking to yourself, is that a serious consideration to ask for a waiver of consent, or am I just doing that because I think it's the easy way out? So it really does make you think about where your data is coming from, what its purpose was in the first place, particularly if it's retrospective data, data that's been gathered beforehand, and what are you going to do with it, again, to not identify the participants, and, you know, whether it's worthwhile overall, whether your project is a worthwhile project.
So how about the two types of research, qualitative or quantitative? Here's Associate Professor Chris Cuthbertson, surgeon and lecturer at Monash Rural Health, to give you a quick overview of them.
Quantitative research is what we're most familiar with in medical trials. It's the idea of converting data to measurements. So we tend to create ordinal scales and then measure an effect based on the numerical difference between one group and another. It also relies on an assumption that there is or at least to a degree, that there is one true world and we're just trying to come up with ways of describing it. It's very uncommon in quantitative research to talk about differences in perspective and things like that. So it tends to be linked to the idea that there is one truth and we're just trying to discover it. Qualitative research comes to things from a different point of view. It tends to sit more in the idea that everybody has a different experience in their world and not everybody will have the same perspective on the same thing. And it really depends on what's happened to you in the past and what will happen to you in the future and the particular situation on the day, of course, depending on the question. So qualitative tries to describe that grey wooliness, the descriptive words. So we edge into this in medical research, in classical medical research sometimes by doing surveys and then trying to describe what those surveys mean. But true qualitative research, it's a lot more about trying to figure out themes and theories about what's going on in people's brains and trying to find the consistencies between different experiences rather than trying to measure that 75% of people think this way or 25% of people think this way. And so it's where theories come from. It's sort of back to front in that in qualitative research, we tend to look at what people are describing and come up with a theory. In quantitative research, we tend to start with a theory or a hypothesis and measure to see if that's true.
In terms of the difference between the two, is there one that you would recommend to someone who's just starting out and perhaps doing their very first research project?
I don't think there's any difference between which one you would do. I think if you've worked in a medical field, we tend to understand quantitative research a bit more intuitively. It's often what we've read a lot more of, and we understand what it means. I think coming to qualitative research from the medical field requires a bit of a transformation in how you think about things. I think more important than which one you start with is make sure that the type of research you're doing is matched to the experience of the person who's helping you. So ideally you should have a supervisor or a mentor and they will be able to help you. It's really, really hard to do quantitative research with somebody who's really a lot more experienced in qualitative research, and the same is true in reverse. I do think that sometimes we think of research as an either or, and if you come up in a particular question that you want to know the answers to, sometimes counting numbers and quantitative is not going to give you a great answer to that question. And we still try and sort of force it in that way. And so ideally you'd be eventually skilled in both. And so then you can choose the right one for the project that you have at the time.
And what bearing would picking one over the other have on the overall outcome of a research project?
Well, I think that depending on what your research question is, so in qualitative research, we talk a lot more about a research question, but we also talk about that in quantitative research. But depending on what your research question is, if you choose the wrong technique, you'll end up with the results that don't mean anything or that can't be used by somebody else in the future. And it's more that your time will be wasted a little bit. Equally, if you try and do something in a technique that you're not familiar with or you don't do well or you don't have enough support in, you'll also end up wasting your time. And we see that, look, it's really quite easy to conceptualize. We see that all the time in projects that are set up and underpowered or don't demonstrate anything that would be clinically useful. So I think they're just extra tools that we have to help us do the research that we're passionate about.
Alongside that risk of your research data not being useful for other future research projects, how important is it to decide right from the start of a research project which sort of route you're going to go down to influence the overall usability of the data for the research that you're currently doing, as well as perhaps your ability to execute those research outcomes you're trying to achieve?
Okay, so I don't think it's really important to decide right from the start, but it is, I think, important to be open to different things. There's a lot of people who come from a medical world who end up doing mixed methods research, which basically, to a degree, can be translated as a mix of quantitative and qualitative. And the idea of that is you get some sort of descriptions of answers to questions in words that you have to try and figure out what people are saying, which is the more qualitative thing. And you also have some numerical-based outcomes. Like the classic is a Likert scale. So did you like it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? And then using those as well. So it doesn't mean that you have to do either or, and it doesn't mean that you have to start at the beginning and say, I'm only ever going to do this way and not change your mind halfway through and decide that you're actually also going to add something else in. But I think that you should be respectful of the different techniques that are required for different data to analyze them adequately. I think that makes a real big difference. And ideally, you know at the start basically what you're doing, but sometimes things do change, and that doesn't wreck the data. That sometimes you have to do that to make it better.
From what I understand, you've shifted from quantitative research to favour qualitative research. Is there any reason for that?
Well, so the research I did earlier in my career was based around my PhD, which was in surgery. So I looked at animals who had pancreatitis, and I treated them with hyperbaric oxygen to see if that would be an effective treatment. And that was really a lot based on measurement and numbers and even changing pictures into scores and things like that. So that was very quantitative, and it was very much based on the assumption that there is one truth and we have to discover that truth. That was, 5 or 10 years ago. Now I've moved into an area I research more in medical education skills. So I'm looking at professional skills and consultation skills, and I'm trying to figure out why people do things the way that they do. And it's an area that's really largely under-researched. Because everybody in that situation brings their different personality and their different experiences to how they do things, there's no right and there's no wrong in this situation, that then qualitative and having descriptions and theories about what's going on in people's processes is much more useful to explore that data. And so I've shifted, I guess, predominantly into doing more qualitative research, and I'm finding it really fascinating because it's really about exploring why things happen and how things happen and how things change over time rather than counting things. And it's exciting to be a part of. Particularly from a surgical point of view and in a medical point of view, there is a feeling that words and how we describe our experiences are less valuable. And I find that a bit disappointing. Our experiences and what we're doing as we go through are really important, and it's a great way that we can understand what patients are feeling and what doctors are feeling when they're in different situations and how that impacts care and how they deal with different situations. It is really a lot harder with qualitative research to see what you do and see what the outcome will be. And that's the way our brains are primed in medical research and when we're looking at evidence-based medicine. And I think we miss a whole big field of interesting research and ideas and topics by that sort of research blindness a little bit. So I would love it if people could consider that sort of exploratory technique as a really valid part of medical research. I think there's a real deficiency of it, particularly in surgery, but lots of medical fields. And it's a great field for exploration in the future and a really exciting thing to become involved in.
Perhaps you're still not sure which type of research to pursue. Here's Professor Frank Bowden, infectious disease physician and researcher at Monash Rural Health, to unpack some of the advantages and disadvantages of the two.
Qualitative methods might include the following. You may record interviews with your subject, and the transcripts of those interviews are used as the basis for your subsequent analysis. The interview process itself can be structured, semi-structured, or unstructured. You might have a series of questions which you're going to ask at the beginning, or you may not. The interviewer herself can be involved in the observation of the interviewer, and you may record those observations. So the interviewer may be looking at the level of anxiety that has been generated by the interview, or whether the person is becoming more and more comfortable as they progress in a particular line of answering your questions. You can give your participants diaries and journals, and they can take them home and fill in answers as they occur to the participant over a prolonged period of time. You can record people, you can do audio recordings. Qualitative data analysis, just because there's no statistics, doesn't mean that there's not a formal structure. There are many different approaches to the qualitative data analysis. To give you one example, in a thematic analysis, you would collect the information that you have been seeking, perhaps through your transcripts. You read the transcripts and you become familiar with that data, which effectively means reading through however many transcripts there are. You then look to see how you're going to code the data that you're deriving or the information that you're deriving from those transcripts. And then you search for themes. You don't begin with a theme. You search for themes throughout the data. Is there something common? Have I heard this before from some of the participants? Is there no common theme that I can identify? You then review that theme. You then define them and you name them. And then you subsequently write your report. There is an incredible amount of detail in this, and it takes more than a superficial look at the information to get something meaningful from the data. There are strengths of qualitative research. I mean, you don't have a predetermined view about the subject. It's an interactive process. It involves both the participant and the researcher, which means that the researcher becomes an important part of the research itself. Now, that might not be a strength. That could be a weakness. And the researcher may bring some biases, both known and unknown, to the interview process and may influence the person being interviewed. Again, the supporters of qualitative research say that you get a deeper involvement in the subject by the researcher, so that ultimately the researcher becomes more expert in an understanding of that particular topic than would someone who is just involved in quantitative research. To me, one of the great strengths of qualitative research is that it allows the researcher to account for the ambiguities of the real world. But of course, there are weaknesses of qualitative research. It's costly. It's time-consuming. You can only do so many interviews in a day. You can only enroll so many people and follow them for so long. So you end up with small sample sizes. And this can mean that the biases which are inherent in small sample sizes might become the most important part of your research. Qualitative research is difficult to replicate. And so the questions of external validity and reliability become very important here. It's not to say they don't with quantitative research as well, but within the qualitative field, these are particularly important. And therefore, is this research finding generalizable? Now, quantitative methods, there are many. We can do cross-sectional surveys. We can do practice audits. We can do cohort studies, case-controlled studies, randomized controlled trials. And to try and compare them to qualitative research. I mean, this is an objective approach. We're looking for answers to specified questions. Quantitative research lets us test other research findings and theories. We can use the same methodology that someone used in another place, in another time, and see whether those results hold true within the population we're studying. Therefore, replication is possible. But for those of you who have done the first part of my evidence-based medicine course, you'll know that that replication is actually not the norm in quantitative research. And most studies in the quantitative field are not reproducible. Quantitative research has many weaknesses. And while we think it's objective, is it truly objective? What is the influence of the participation of the researcher in the assessment of the outcome that we're looking at? There really is only one way to really get our research in the quantitative field as inverted commas pure as possible, and that's the randomized clinical trial. But I want to make the point that quantitative research is not just randomized controlled trials. In fact, most quantitative research involves other methodologies. Bias is probably the most important problem that we see in any research, and quantitative research usually is subject to bias because it has not put in place a mechanism such as randomization to minimize bias. But of course, we know there are many other ways that we have to employ, that we must employ to minimize bias. So let's go into perhaps some more concrete examples. So, research question: do beta blockers prevent migraine? Well, if I want to answer that question, I've got to do quantitative research. And that could be a randomized controlled trial, but I could also do a case control study. Now, we know that the case control study is by no means a good way, but it might be the only way that we can assess whether there is a preventive effect, particularly if the outcome we're looking at is rare and it's not practical to do the study. But ultimately, an RCT is going to be your gold standard. The next question we could ask is long-term beta blocker use associated with the development of cancer? Well, clearly, this is a quantitative question. And we could do this through a cross-sectional study, a prospective cohort, a retrospective cohort, or a case control study. But what if I was to say, well, what's influencing people to take their migraine medication? What helps with adherence to therapy? So there's two ways. I could do a quantitative or a qualitative approach. With a quantitative approach, I could ask some specific predetermined questions in a cross-sectional survey, or I could go much deeper into that question with a qualitative thematic analysis, which might be an in-depth interview with semi-structured or open questions for people who suffer from migraine. The last question is migraine a socially constructed disease? Which clearly sounds like qualitative research and certainly not amenable to any quantitative questioning, but might be something which was open to a grounded theory analysis. So that's a very, very quick outline of quantitative and qualitative research. Just, I think, an introduction.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about the study and training opportunities across regional Victoria by heading to monash.edu/medicine/rural-health. This episode was part of a series of conversations with doctors in regional Victoria. There's more episodes available which focus on a wide range of medical specialties. We're available anywhere you can find good podcasts. The Northwest Victoria and Gippsland Regional Training Hubs have commissioned this podcast to help medical students and junior doctors learn more about training and practicing medicine in regional Australia. There are hubs all across the country, and to find out where your nearest regional training hub is, visit the link in the episode show notes or just search regional training hubs. And finally, this podcast was brought to you by Monash Rural Health, presented by Patrick Laverick, that's me, and it was made possible by funding from the Rural Health Multidisciplinary Training Program at the Commonwealth Department of Health.